Okay, everybody, welcome to the People Speak Show. This is your host, Charles Giuliani. Got a very important guest this evening, Dr. Stephen Jones. He's actually a returning guest. We've had him on numerous times over the past several years. He hardly needs an introduction, but for those that aren't familiar with him and his work, he's a professor of physics at Brigham Young University. Are you, in fact, still with Brigham Young?
No, I retired at age 57 a number of years ago, Charles.
Okay. Well, that's good that you retired. They didn't throw you out.
I'm actually an emeritus professor now. So.
Oh, okay. But anyway, Dr. Jones is one of several professionals that has come forward since 9/11, been very vocal, in fact, about his findings at Ground Zero, showing that something else went on there other than what we were told. And anyway, without any further ado, why don't you update us, Dr. Jones, on what some of your latest findings are? I know in the past you've talked about the red chips of unignited thermite in the debris that you had found.
Right. Yeah. You know, most of my research at this time, Charles, is in the field of alternate energy. For instance, next month I'm planning to be at the International Conference on Cold Fusion 18, it's called. So I don't claim to have any new research results in the field of 9/11, although I do try to contribute and stay up on that. I was on the radio here in Salt Lake, that's about 6 weeks ago. And, I try to help out where I can. But most of my research effort now is in the field of energy.
Something which, of course, is being horribly suppressed. I know, was it back in the late 80s when this discovery was first made? Mm-hmm. Two scientists, I don't recall their names, I'm sure you know.
Yeah. Actually, yeah, if I could talk about that a little bit. It, of course,
sure.
Very interesting. Very interesting to me, the whole cold fusion saga. Let's see, it goes way back, but let me pick it up in 1985 when I wrote a paper with a colleague of mine, Professor Paul Palmer at BYU. That first paper was with Clint Van Sicklin, sorry. Paul Palmer and I wrote a paper with others a few years later. First paper was with Clint Van Sicklin, and it was about fusion in metallic hydrogen in the planet Jupiter. So it's kind of interesting. And then I gave a talk on this subject, which is now called cold fusion, or fusion in metals, in 1986 at BYU. And Paul Palmer picked that up, and we started doing experiments. And so we do feel that, well, it's not just a feeling. Okay, we have to, as scientists, we do experiments. We don't just speculate. Hopefully we do experiments, and that's what we did. So we developed a very sensitive neutron detector, and by 1989, we were ready to publish our results, which we did in the journal Nature, peer-reviewed paper, and you can find it there, April 1989. Nature article about our cold fusion results. And so we talked about fusion in the planets, in particular in the Earth. By this stage, we'd found some evidence, but we also gave experimental results showing neutron production from cold fusion. Now, fusion between deuterons, which is what we're studying there, produces neutrons and helium-3, also protons and what's called tritons, the heavy hydrogen nucleus, tritium nucleus. So the paper was a bit controversial, to say the least. But it was, I like to use the term orthogonal, which means quite different. You know, it really is at right angles to the paper by Pons and Fleischmann. Those are the names you were searching
for,
probably.
Yeah, that's it,
right. But you see, they claimed excess heat, and they visited our lab, and having seen our results, they sort of made a connection there, which I have never thought was a correct connection. That is that their excess heat was due to fusion, because you can't, in order to establish fusion, which is a joining of nuclei, right, fusing together, joining together of these hydrogen nuclei, a deuterium is heavy hydrogen nuclei. So you have to look for the products. That follows from E equals MC squared. There has to be some change in the products relative to the initial ingredients, the starting nuclei. There has to be a change there. Yep. And the energy then follows from E equals MC squared, but you got to look for that mass change. And so we did, and we found it, and that has since been verified, and it is fusion. What they found is, I think, very interesting. But as I pointed out to, especially to Fleischmann, I said, look, you can't call this fusion if you don't have the nuclear products commensurate, you know, the same level, to go with your heat. And heat means a lot of fusion if it's fusion. Well, by now, there are still a lot of workers in this field, including myself, really. But what I've said from the beginning was, it does not look like fusion. You should not call it fusion. Now, the conference next month, July, in was at the University of Missouri, and I'll be there. But the conference is titled Anomalous Heat Effects. I like that much better. Anomalous Heat Effects, you see. Not heat due to fusion. Okay, it doesn't say that anywhere in their conference write-up. Rather, it's anomalous. We don't know what it is. And that's what I tried to anchor. And even Fleischmann, shortly before he passed away, rest his soul, did admit that, you know, it was a mistake that he had made to call it fusion way back in, well, it was 1989, they had their press conference. So if I can just clarify that, there's two parts to this field. One is real fusion, which is very tiny and does produce neutrons and so on that I mentioned. And the other part is the excess heat, the anomalous heat, which does not produce neutrons. And so it should not be confused. It should not be conflated with cold fusion. So it's just simply anomalous heat, but it is a very interesting stuff, and that's what the conference will focus on, I'm quite sure. Actually, I looked at the conference coming up at University of Missouri. It will talk about both areas, both the fusion, the cold fusion, that is neutrons and so on, and, as well as the anomalous heat, which really should be a, I mean, they're doing a pretty good job keeping those separate now, I think. But that's what I've been arguing for decades now.
I'm just so glad to see that the research is still going forward in spite of all of the... Yeah. Yeah. I didn't realize that you were at the helm of this right from the beginning.
Well, at the helm of the cold fusion part of it. In fact, that was the title Paul Palmer and I gave to what we were doing, which is... We sometimes call it metal-catalyzed fusion because the fusion occurs in metals. We were talking about and using palladium way early. By the way, about over 3 years before we heard of Pons and Fleischmann, my paper on this subject was submitted and published in Journal of Physics G in 1986, but submitted long before we heard of Pons and Fleischmann. And so I really regret that some accused me of stealing their idea. But people, I was working on this at least 3 years before I even heard of these guys. And furthermore, our results are really quite orthogonal to their claims of anomalous heat. Now, I have become persuaded that the anomalous heat is real, but not fusion. And that was what I was trying to say back. You know, 1989, the early 90s. It's study it, but don't confuse it with cold fusion.
Well, obviously, a viable, potentially viable source of energy, though, no question.
Well, you know, that is quite possible, and that's what's exciting about it. And we'll see. We'll see the latest results that come out next next month. This meeting now is basically annual. The title, the rubric, Cold Fusion, still goes with it, and Cold Fusion is discussed, our neutron results, for example. But at the same time, the title of the conference is Understanding Anomalous Heat Effects. That's the key, is trying to understand that. And calling it anomalous, wow, it's just the right thing to do.
So how many scientists do you anticipate will show up at the conference?
That's a good question. I'm guessing around 120, plus or minus. It's hard to say. It's an international.
Oh, I was going to say, is it international? Yeah, wow. Right. Now, are there mostly foreign scientists, or is it kind of a mix, half and half?
It'd be a pretty good mix. The meeting is held in, so where was it last year? I believe it was in South Korea. I did not go. I don't have the funding to fly now to South Korea, but Missouri is really close to where I'm now living. So,
sure.
I mean, the University of Missouri is close. So I will be driving, and so it alternates between the United States and another country. And this year it's in the United States, and so that would tend to mean there'd be more American scientists there, I suppose.
Excellent. So what kind of suppression have you, I'm sure you've faced quite a bit.
Yeah, gosh, suppression is, it's kind of a hard topic to discuss because on the one hand, you see it happening, but it's not something you want to advertise because it can be a bit discouraging. let me give you an example. So on this anomalous heat, which I've been researching, I was working with a researcher in California, and he had a device. I guess I'll go ahead and tell you, it's a true story. It happened this year. It's just kind of sad to relate. So he had a device that was evidently producing anomalous heat. And he wanted to send it to me so I could do some detailed scientific measurements to look at the input power and the output power. Now, this is not electrolysis. It doesn't have to be electrolysis for anomalous heat. That's one of the other things I'm trying to encourage the researchers in this field to understand is, you know, you don't just have to stick with electrolysis or even hydrogen gas loading. In this case, this had rotating disks and in water, so or oil, you know, either one. So anyway, let me skip to the suppression question that you asked about, Charles. So what happened was he sent me the device. It was about 2.5 feet tall, and he boxed it up in a wood crate and shipped it to me by, I'm going to go ahead and name him FedEx, you know. Shipped it to me by FedEx. Now, when it arrived at my place, it was in two separate pieces. And the device itself, the heart of it, had been disassembled because the nuts were off the bolts. It had four bolts holding it together. The nuts were completely off and just rolling around the bottom of the box. Now, he had sent me pictures. You know, I know what it was supposed to look like. And when it arrived, it was in two separate pieces, and our hearts just sunk. And so we looked at the FedEx record, and we noticed that one during shipment, actually on a Friday morning, it was checked out of FedEx. They tell you that. And then it was returned to, this was in Sacramento, to FedEx Monday late afternoon. So he and I both called, he was the shipper, I was the receiver, and we independently called FedEx. And I went around with them for a good hour or so. They did not know, or they wouldn't say, where the shipment was during that time when it was checked out of FedEx and you know, gone for Friday all day. Oh, wait, see, Friday, did I get that right? Anyway, it's gone for 3 days. I've got the detailed reports, of course, I recorded those. And So where, you know, where was it? They wouldn't say. Who took it apart? Can't say. Is there any way for us to find out who took it apart? No, not really. So, you know, it's like you have to understand we can't say who took it apart, but surely you know who took it apart. So, yeah. You know, to me that was suppression, Charles, because now at that point I called using Skype. I very carefully took the device apart now at that stage. And with the inventor looking on, and we found that the device, the discs had been removed. They were not in the same order. They were scratched,
wow,
scored, and it was not functioning. I mean, it properly. It wasn't working like it was when he sent it. They had taken the discs off, obviously, because they were in a different order, and put them back in a different order. The order mattered. And they had not paid attention, or at least they didn't care. They slapped it back together. They didn't even put the bolts on the container for this device. I mean, the nuts on the bolts. So we were very disappointed, and you know, it just shocked us that. And so we couldn't get any relief from FedEx, and he actually filed a complaint. And then shortly, a day or two later, he called them up and said, well, how's that complaint coming? They said, we have no record of a complaint. So we filed a complaint again. A couple days later, he calls up, and again, we have no record that you filed a complaint. So, wow. You know, short of going through the court system and trying to find out, you know, just what agency had taken this apart and they ruined it. I mean, I paid for the shipping, and I, you know, it was not cheap because this thing is fairly heavy, and you know, it's a sad but true story of suppression in this energy field. So I'm afraid that is going on.
Do you anticipate any sabotaging of the conference coming up?
That's an interesting question. I hope not. I would be quite surprised if. There weren't people there interested, I say, government or big oil or whoever, there to look at it. I mean, this is talking about a new source of energy. So you would be surprised if they were not represented. And furthermore, it's at a solid University of Missouri in Columbia, Missouri. And with scientists presenting their results in a very sober and serious way. I doubt there'll be any sabotaging of equipment there. I wouldn't expect that, of course, but I will.
Well, I meant even like hecklers showing up and trying to discredit and, you know.
You know, I kind of doubt it as well. The format is very much a scientific. It's not a press conference format, although they may have press conference. That'd be interesting. That's where you might expect a heckler, right? It's more, whereas at this is a sober scientific colloquium setting where scientists will get up and present their results. And I'm looking forward to it immensely, but I don't really think it will be subject to heckling. I can't imagine it, yes, but I would be very surprised. I would be very surprised if they were heckling. It's more likely it'll be ignored by, you know, the media. Although I'm hoping to do what I can to write I'm planning to write up something, and I've been in touch with a newspaper, and we'll see if they will accept and publish a report it's not cold fusion. It's anomalous heat. It's not as catchy as cold fusion.
Yeah.
So we have to explain that. But, you know, the public will key in to that term cold fusion. Oh, yeah, it's still going on. But it's not cold. It's not fusion anymore, the heat part of it. The heat part is very interesting. And like I say, I've been researching that myself. And so I'm looking forward to the conference and seeing how that comes out.
Do you have any theory yourself as to what you think might be going on causing this?
You know, that is a good question. Let's see if I can find. There's a let's see, this may take me just a minute to find. So there's a group at the Naval Research Laboratory, and they have been pursuing this anomalous heat for a few years. This is going to take me just a minute. Let's see, how am I going to find that? Anyway, they...
Federally funded.
They're federally funded. That's true. So, you know, it's not like... But it's a small... It's a very small effect that they're seeing. And that's why I don't really think that they're going to have significant suppression, because it's so small. And furthermore, it's not 100% reproducible at all. It's sporadic. And this has been one of the problems that this anomalous heat research community has faced now for years.
But that's pretty anomalous itself, because you would expect the government itself to be wanting to suppress this, and yet they're funding it. Are they going to publicize these studies?
Yeah. I mean, publicize, maybe. But they'll probably be publishing it. Let me see. You have to understand, Charles, when it's small, it doesn't threaten big oil, right? I mean, we're just talking about a little effect that happens like every week or two, you know, and then you get a little burst of heat. But for a scientist, it's very exciting. But as far as threatening world oil production, I don't think there's anything there. But let me just read this. These guys, this is their abstract for this meeting in Missouri, University of Missouri. It says, this is by the group. I found their abstract, and that's available publicly. If you go to University of Missouri, ICCF18, then that'll bring up, and then you have to do a little digging. But the first author is Kidwell, Kidwell. Anyway, it says, we have explored the field of low-energy nuclear reactions for about 8 years, focusing on transmutation, electrochemistry, and gas loading, with the latter two being the most fruitful. And they go on. But, you know, again, it doesn't have to just be that. Gas loading is something that we did. I'm pretty sure we were the first to do that. That would be about 87, I think, that we started doing gas loading. Anyway, it is quite, it's very interesting. But, okay, down to their conclusions, blah, blah. We can find no artifacts to explain the data for some of our results, and therefore we must conclude that an unknown source of energy exists and is worthy of more attention. Now, that's quite a statement from these half a dozen scientists here. And, you know, to say that they conclude that there's an unknown source of energy.
Mm.
Now, I've talked to one of them in detail. He's a friend of mine from way back. And he noted that they looked for nuclear products and they don't see it. So the anomalous heat is becoming, again, disconnected from nuclear fusion, which is what I've been arguing for years. And I'm glad they, you know, they're coming to that. And notice when they conclude, we must conclude that an unknown source of energy exists. Now, that's quite a statement. They did not say fusion. They did not say low energy nuclear reactions. They said unknown source of energy.
Wow.
To me, that's exciting. That's the key to solving this puzzle, I believe, is opening. See, it's taking the blinders off, just as you do with 9/11. You know, you take those blinders off, you look at the data, and you say, I'm not going to force this to be nuclear because there's no nuclear product. So I'm looking for energy. We can measure that. We may not know the source, but we can measure it. Next.
So we're looking potentially at literally a new, this is revolutionary, kind of like discovering a new element or something, but even more significant than that, a new form of energy.
That's right.
The four being, what is it, electromagnetic,
nuclear.
Strong and weak.
That's right, strong nuclear, and weaker.
And then gravity. So this could be a fifth unknown form of energy. That's astonishing.
Quite possibly so. And it would be astonishing. And it's, you know, again, it's a very small effect, but scientifically, and you see how this could go forward. As a scientist, I find it absolutely fascinating. And, you know, I've been working in the alternate energy field since, I look back, probably about 1982. That's when I proposed to look at muon catalyzed fusion. And we did that, an experiment at Los Alamos Maison Physics Facility. There's no bomb application for that at all. It's just that, and that's one of the things, by the way, people are concerned about in this field of alternate energy that I've run into here. They really don't want this to be used for war in general. Now, there may be some exceptions. I just, that's my personal bias, and I've run into a lot of people like that. So,
well, that's good.
Yeah, and so, you know, we're searching for this, but with an effort to make it available to the public. We don't want it to be taken by the warmongers or by big oil. I think you understand, Charles, what I'm talking about.
Oh, sure. But yeah. Do you suspect that the powers that be that do this suppressing or just ignoring whatever, do you suspect that they've already stumbled on this and...
You know, that is a tough question. This particular effect, I mean, look, these...
In other words, you're just rediscovering something they've already known, you know?
It is quite possible. It is quite possible, but then we'll see. I mean, for instance, these guys are at Naval Research Lab, and they're just, you know, scientists studying this curious effect. As far as I can see, it's a small effect now, and poor reproducibility, they say, and they admit that in their abstract. Less than 6% they talk about. So, you know, whether it's been discovered before is really hard to tell. There have been certainly reports of suppression. I mentioned the personal experience.
Oh, yeah, sure. But has that been your results, too? You know, 6%, is that about...
No, well, actually, okay, this device that was sent to me and was taken apart and non-functional by the time it arrived at my place. Now, there's a clue, because it seemed like they're trying to determine the function. Otherwise, why would they take the discs out and remove the discs? And then, but they weren't being very careful, because they put them back in the wrong order. I mean, the inventor could see that. I was using Skype.
Sure.
And I said, okay, here's this one and this one. He said, that's not the right order.
Wow.
You know? And it takes some care to do it. And anyway, he had the discs in a certain order, and they were magnetized in a certain way. And, you know, I just don't know what those guys were trying to do, but they really messed us up.
They're protecting you from terrorists.
Ah, thank you. Yes. So it's a real, you know, it's just an exciting field to be in scientifically. Challenging because of this, I have to call it overreach, you know, of government, probably somebody overreaching to take a shipment out of the stream of FedEx, right, in the morning, and then, let's see, 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, in the afternoon of the third day, they return it, just about 5 o'clock, they return it, but it's been taken apart and disassembled and put together incorrectly. So,
incredible. I mean,
you got to call that harassment, if not suppression.
Sure. Yeah. Absolutely. I tell you what, we're at the halfway point here. We're going to pause for a short break. When we come back, I get some questions for you. It looks like probably half of them are related to 9/11 and to
That's
this
fine.
Issue. Sure. So we'll get to those when we get back. Short break, folks. Stick with us. Okay, everybody. Welcome back. Once again, we're joined by our guest, Dr. Stephen Jones. He's sharing with us his information about his research into, cold fusion or anomalous heat.
Good. Yep.
Yeah. In this second half here, we're going to be taking questions. I got questions coming in via text. We also got Ed in, what did he say now, Louisiana? I just had it in front of me. Where did it go? Ed from
Indiana,
excuse me, right, is on the line. So are you there, Ed?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
Sure. Go ahead with your question.
Dr. Stephen Jones, I was wondering if you had a chance to read Kevin Ryan's new book, or if you're aware of Kevin Ryan's new book, and if you could give us some thoughts on that. And just basically, what do you think the best potential for 9/11 truth is into breaking into the mainstream media nowadays? Thank you.
Yeah. Good question, Zed. You know, Kevin sent me his new book, and it arrived yesterday. And I've started perusing it. I look forward to reading it. And I've got it in my hands, actually, right this moment. It's called Another 19, Investigating Legitimate 9/11 Suspects by Kevin Ryan. Excellent. From what I can see, it's excellent. You know, Kevin is such a deep researcher. He's a chemist, but, I mean, he researches all sorts of relevant topics, and he's just very good at both researching and referencing. He's got just tons of references here with this. So I'm looking forward to that. I can recommend it just from what I've seen already. As far as the future of the movement of 9/11, you know, we had a fair amount of momentum, I recall, back in 2006. Yeah, now you got me going on cold fusion.
Yeah.
1980s. And
at a time warp there.
Yeah, a little time warp. Yeah, but no, in 2006, we had, you know, we were, remember we were on C-SPAN, and we were in, there was reports in U.S. News and World Report, and, you know, we were getting some media attention. The goal, we had a goal at that time in the community. I wonder if some of you remember what that was. The goal that I recall was not just information, you know, getting a critical mass. People talk about that, but we had a goal, and it was called this: impeach Cheney first. You know, and we had reason for that. We had the testimony of Norman Mineta, which is just damning to Cheney's role there.
I imagine Cheney is one of the other 19 in the book.
I imagine so.
Yeah.
But okay, so what I'm saying is we lost that. I mean, it was just cut off. I was put on administrative leave. I was invited to retire early and so on. I don't necessarily want to go into a lot of detail about that, but it did. That and some other things. I mean, you have people starting to attack each other. It was just amazing right there shortly after the C-SPAN, which was August, right in there of 86 and into September, that time frame. You started having people in the community just viciously attacking each other. And the goal of impeach Cheney was lost. Somehow that got lost in all this stuff. And what I think we need now is another goal. Now, we have this goal of seeking an investigation, which architects and engineers are doing a great job for 9/11 Truth, ae911truth.org. They've got over 1,900 signed up now, architects and engineers.
Wow.
You know?
They've really grown.
Yeah, it's almost 2,000. It continues to grow. And then, 17,000 plus other supporters. So the point is, yeah, there's this progress and we all want this investigation. Well, let's get, specific. Let's get a goal. Who's going to conduct this investigation? Congress? No. You wouldn't want that, right? I mean, let's face it. We got to get some independent group to conduct a serious independent investigation. I'm thinking of a team of engineers that would do that, international, preferably based outside the United States would be good. Some place like, say, Europe, Denmark, maybe, where Niels Harrod is. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But we need to pin that down, is what I'm trying to say. If we can get a goal that we generally agree on, can avoid some of this infighting as we unite again behind a goal, I think we can make progress again. That's what I would hope for.
Was that it, Ed? Are you still there? Or? I think Ed dropped.
Okay.
Let's go to some of these other questions I had come in via text here. Got quite a few. I don't know if we even have time to get to all of them. But this first one is from Arch or Archie in Washington, and he asks, does Dr. Jones think that nuclear power plants in the United States, and in fact all of the nuclear energy, is a danger to the environment and needs to be replaced?
Okay. Now, you see, here's this term nuclear again. And when you say nuclear plants, that means fission. There are no, that is zero, fusion plants producing energy anywhere in the world. That does not happen. If we, what I'm saying is, but he said nuclear, so I'm going to let that include, you know, fusion. If we could get a nuclear power plant, that should be fusion. Now I'm talking about nuclear fusion. That produces innocuous stuff generally. You're fusing hydrogen together, you're getting helium. There are a few other things that you can trap, like neutrons, but gosh, that's easy to shield against neutrons and gammas. So it's not like fission where you're producing all sorts of garbage, you know, radioactive iodine and strontium and so on. Like we had leak out of Fukushima in Japan, you know, remember that with the earthquake. So, and the tsunami. So anyway, I agree that there is a concern that was seen to be tacit in the question with fission. But what I'm looking for is fusion or power plants or this unknown, let me use that terminology, you know, anomalous heat, which we still have to check for safety, and it's quite likely not nuclear at all. But yeah, I think we have to keep our eyes open to, very open to the concerns about the environment and safety. Absolutely.
All right. Let's go to our next question here. This one is kind of multifaceted. Cheyenne from Colorado asks...
Sundar? Cheyenne Sundar?
Yeah, so, yeah, oh, yeah. You know the name?
Well, yeah. If it's really Cheyenne Sundar, I would be surprised. But
this might be. I'm not familiar with that person. This is somebody in research.
Well, let me just tell you, Cheyenne Sundar was the head of the NIST research team, the National Institute of Standards and Technology.
Oh, okay. This is probably a fictitious name, I'm sure.
Yeah, probably so. Go ahead.
Okay. In any case, the question is, are there any BYU or any related qualified scientific associates who support your nanothermite findings but will not go public? And if so, would you be interested in helping them out of the closet now on the program?
Well, that's a good question. And the answer is, the way it's phrased, let me just put it this way. There's a Dr. Jeffrey... Jeffrey Ferrer of the BYU physics department. He's a good friend of mine. I worked with him in studying the red-gray chips, which we determined were thermitic material, active thermitic material, by our experiments. So you must know we published on that. That's been a few years ago now. And, Dr. Ferrer was a co-author on that paper. And so you wouldn't really say he's in the closet. I mean, he published on that. And so I know that he has faced, you talked about suppression. Well, he has to be careful. I understand. He wants to keep his job. And I think that is, given my experience, I understand very well where he's coming from. You know, when I was put on administrative leave, I had a professor, what was his name, Alan Steele at BYU, tell me that it just cast a chill was the term he used, over the campus. So people were starting to look at 9/11, and not just physicists, you understand, engineers, but others. But it just cast a chill over campus, and I think that chill extended more broadly. In fact, it may have been part of this loss of momentum as we sought to impeach Cheney first, you see. So the point is, however, there is, yes, an active fellow, Dr. Ferrer at BYU, and he just has to be careful how he speaks out. But he did join us on this paper.
Excellent.
Hope that answers the question.
Yeah. Let's go to, let's see, we have Laura in Ohio who asks, what does Dr. Jones think about the Richard Gage documentary narrated by Ed Asner, Solving the Mystery? Are you familiar with this one?
Yeah, Building 7, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was quite well done. I don't know that I have any particular detailed critique of it. I thought it was well done. I appreciate that being brought up. You know, AE 9/11 Truth is doing some real good work. This documentary you mentioned on Building 7, and also Experts Speak Out. I was on it. By the way, Dr. Fair of BYU did participate, and his testimony, his discussion about the red gray chips in the 9/11 dust, that's also on that documentary. So yeah, they're doing some real good work there.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I didn't even know Ed Asner was on board with this. I knew
he was
politically outspoken, but I didn't realize that he was a thing. That's great.
Yeah.
Okay, we've got Sean in Missouri who asks, does Dr. Jones think that a viable alternative energy is possible, as it seems that, well, kind of like we were talking earlier, that money, interests, control, and keep what is in place, even if what is in place is ineffective, wasteful, and perhaps even dangerous?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good point. You know, we have to recognize that we live kind of in a matrix, right? I mean, we're trying to do some good research here. I think as long as we keep our claims small, you know, as opposed to hyping it in all the newspapers, if we can keep our claims reasonably small and scientific and non-challenging to, say, big oil, then I think we can go ahead and progress. You have to remember, in this alternate energy field, it's not just Americans or even, say, British scientists. There are scientists in both countries, but there's also Japanese. I think they're a little more free to speak. India, Italy, Chalani, you know. So you have people all over the world who are speaking out, Russia and China. So you have people all over the world talking about this anomalous heat on the one hand, and also the actual fusion products on the other at a much lower level, but still very interesting.
They can't keep this under wraps forever.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah, you got so many countries involved, and sure, you're going to expect some opposition and some just ignoring you if they can.
Yeah.
But I think we're making progress. We'll see what happens with this conference. Stay tuned, you know, next,
sure,
just a month from now.
Right. We got a follow-up question from Cheyenne again. Nod, nod, wink, wink. And the question is, what is the simplest, shortest sentence that a layperson can use to rebut a doubter claiming that the red-gray chips are not unexploded nanothermite?
You know, for a short sentence, I would have to say read the paper. I mean, we've put a lot of work into that paper. And, you have to look at the totality of the evidence.
And that is on your website, right?
It is. If you Google Dr. BYU, funny, isn't it? That brings, after all these years of being retired, that still brings up my name on top. And so it's Dr. space BYU. That brings up my name on top. And then you go down just a little and you'll see these peer-reviewed papers with links. There's one of them that is not online, unfortunately. That's my first one. But it's still there. And anyway, there's links to including this red-gray chip paper. And if you just go to Dr. BYU and link on that, you know, with photographs. The most important, the pithy part of that paper that demonstrates the presence of thermitic material would be, in my opinion, you know, I'm involved in the paper, is that we did studies where we actually ignited the red-gray material in a differential scanning calorimeter, And this showed after we, and then after, it was so a very interesting thermal trace, but after that, we found molten, iron-rich spheres. I mean, they had been molten because they're in spherical shape. You know, surface tension of a liquid pulls it into.
Solidified, yeah.
Yeah. So there you find iron-rich, which indicates the iron oxide had been, which we found in the raw material, had been reduced to iron. At least a lot of it had, because it was.
Yeah.
So there you go, and that's, you know, that's more than one sentence. Just go to my website and read the paper. That's the best thing I can suggest.
Yeah, you can understand people wanting things to be simplified. Yeah, just give me one quick sentence, but it's kind of like saying, you know, 9/11 didn't happen the way we were told. There's one sentence, but that doesn't give you the information. There's no quick
bullet.
You got to research. You got to read. You got to investigate.
Yeah. I'd like to point out while we're on that subject, Charles, that if you go to, since we're talking about this website, if you go there, the paper that I wrote, 14 points, that paper, has not been discussed as much, and I think that's interesting. It is also a very solid set of research there, you know, other with co-authors, including Kevin Ryan and others. The point is that has data that's a little more accessible, if I could put it that way, to the public. I mean, I talk about Building 7. I talk about how NIST squirmed when, you know, they said there are no explosives and no evidence for explosives. And, you know, well, did you look? No, we didn't look. Well, how can you say there's no evidence for explosives if you didn't even look? You know, so we caught them in a couple points. And they also admit, it's quoted in the paper, that they cannot explain the total collapse of the towers. You know, they came out and admitted that in a letter to us after we did a request for correction, a formal challenge to their publication on 9/11. So, you know, this paper, the 14 points paper, I would just like to encourage people to read as well. I guess that's all I have to say about that. But I think that's it's a peer-reviewed paper and a paper that's more accessible to many in the public, I think.
Sure. Let's see. We've only got a few more minutes here. I can try to squeeze in a few more. Fred in Canada asks, "What about a class action suit against Larry Silverstein?"
You know, lawsuits may be a good approach. I'm a researcher, and so yeah, I don't know quite how to grapple with the lawsuit. I have encouraged lawsuits that have come along. I don't think I've ever discouraged any. But one thing that we did succeed in with a friend of mine, we did a FOIA, Freedom of Information Act request, and we did this with U.S. Geological Survey. It was not a lawsuit exactly, but it's, you know, along the same lines. And boy, they did not like it. They made that clear. But they did finally. They asked for an extension, you know, please give us more time. They finally complied. But, you know, when they sent us the data, this is their study of the World Trade Center dust, which we were doing independently, so we were kind of checking them. And sure enough, they had iron-rich spheres in their dust, which they admitted to. But anyway, so I looked through, and they also had a molten that is, globular, almost spherical ball in there, which they showed in their data, which they didn't put in their paper. But this had, let's see, what was it? Oh, it was one of the refractory metals, very high melting temperature, tungsten, I believe. No, it was molybdenum. Yeah. So anyway, the point is, it was very important to us to get that paper. We learned a lot, and they were aware then of the very high temperatures, this anomaly in the dust, you know, extremely high temperatures. Where'd that come from? How'd they get extremely high temperatures when you're burning jet fuel and office furniture, you know? You're not going to melt molybdenum.
Right.
Right, you can't. Or iron either. You can't melt iron with just kerosene or jet fuel or office furniture. Anyway, let me just one follow-up talking about a little harassment. So not only did they delay, but when they sent us, most of the data that they sent was coded. I mean, it was tucked away where you couldn't just read it with your computer, you know. So we had to send it to a decoding expert, Remember, this is Freedom of Information Act, and they send us coded data. I'm sitting there, you know what?
Wow.
Freedom of Information? I mean, how much time do they spend coding this stuff? So anyway, we sent it to an expert, and he decoded it for us.
Wow, no kidding.
I thought it was absolutely hilarious. But, you know, these guys, I don't know what they're – would you say they're trying to cover something up? I'm afraid you would have to say that. Which in itself –
quite obviously.
Yeah. See, the cover-up itself is evidence of foul play. Something's not being told to us that's – it's not telling us the whole truth or they're hiding some.
Got a big, long habit of doing that.
Yeah, I'm afraid so. And it hasn't – you know, transparency, you know.
Right.
It has not changed much, has it, in the last few years?
No, unfortunately. Let's see how many more we can squeeze in the last couple of minutes. We got Frank in Canada who asks, what is your opinion of the visual and quantitative evidence that micro-nukes were used? I guess he's referring to the Judy Woods research here that, you know.
I don't know if she does that. She talks about other. She talks about a beam.
Or beam weapons. Yeah, that's true.
But he's talking about mini nukes, which is a it's a hypothesis that should be looked at. I did look at it. I looked to see. See, you have to do experiments. So it's one thing to speculate, and it's another thing to do experiments. So that's what I want to do, and insist that scientists do is experiments. You know, we don't just settle ourselves. Well, it could have been, you know, mini nuclear, but they want it to be fusion. Well, or I could be fission, I guess. But in either case, there's a lot of neutrons produced, whether it's
fission. Use cold fusion.
Well, you know, we're talking about destroying a building. Unfortunately, that's a pretty small effect. But anyway, so so I looked to see if there's any neutron activation. I had some steel from the World Trade Center, which is sent to me for inspection. That's a long story too, but I no longer have that in my possession, but I did get to look at it, and there was no radioactivity. And there are others that looked at the residue that I did too, the dust, to see if there's any activity in there. There were some scientists shortly after 9/11 that, for whatever reason, they looked for radioactive iodine, and they didn't see any. You know, I mean, it was background level. That means there was nothing above background. Where if you've got a nuclear bomb going off in a building, you're going to have a lot of. Tell me how you can avoid, these nuclear products. It's the same problem that Pons and Fleischmann had. They had this anomalous heat. They said, oh, it's got to be fusion. No. If it's fusion, you got to have nuclear products. If it's a mini nuke, you got to have nuclear products.
Right.
You know, it's just almost, it's equals MC squared again, just as basic as you can get in physics. And, have fun. Knock yourself out. But give me some data that shows that you've got nuclear products, okay?
Right. Well, I tell you what, Dr. Jones, we've actually run out of time. I had a few more questions I want to get to, but we're not going to be able to do that. But I wanted to thank you for taking out time and sharing with us. And I look forward to seeing, the papers that come out of this conference.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, I appreciate it, Charles. I always enjoy talking to you, and I appreciate your letting me, discuss items of interest. 9/11, energy research. I'm interested in a few other things too, actually. But those are the two that I like to talk about the most, I guess. So thanks again.
Yeah, thank you. Take care. We'll have you on again sometime.
All right. Thanks, Charles. See you.
Yep. Take care. Okay, folks, that's it for this week. I believe we're going to be taking a hiatus next week. But stay tuned, and we'll be letting you know on the site there on bbsradio.com. Check out the People Speak page, and you can see what's going to be coming up in future weeks. So until then, until next time, take care. We'll see you then.